From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made 18 months ago in Strong Memorial Hospital's neonatal intensive care unit. A baby girl, Lucia Rojas, was born 3 months early and was fighting for her life. She weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces, and doctors told her mother that Lucia might not make it through the weekend. But doctors also said breast milk would help heal Lucia's intestines. Her mother pumped, but soon her supply dwindled. That's when Mary Sarah Rojas began ordering donor breast milk for her daughter from a milk bank in Boston. It cost $4 an ounce, and even with financial assistance, Mary Sarah's family paid about half of her husband's yearly income. 2 surgeries and 3 months later, Lucia Rojas was home with her parents in Walworth, and she wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for donor milk. Donor breast milk has been called liquid gold. It could trade for 400 times more than the price of crude oil, and if sold off the shelf, it could cost more than 150 times the price of a gallon of cow's milk. So long story short, access to safe, affordable donor milk isn't always easy. But here's some good news. Donor milk banks are making a comeback. In fact, there's a brand new milk bank here in New York State. And on Monday, the American Academy of Pediatrics released guidelines to protect the safety of and promote access to donor milk. My colleague, WXXI's health reporter Karen Shakurji, worked on this story for about a month. And it is excellent, excellent reporting. You can listen to parts 1 and 2 on our website, WXXINews.org, and we'll link her story to this podcast. But in the meantime, Karen is here in studio with me to discuss the many elements of this topic and to help answer your questions about donor breast milk. So Karen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Welcome to Connections. This is your first time on the show?
This is my first time on
the
show. Yes, it is.
And Karen and I have a packed house this hour and phone lines. I'm glad to have with us in studio Dr. Jeffrey Myers, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Neonatology and Associate Medical Director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. Dr. Myers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm glad I got your whole title in there. And Diane Cassidy is in studio. She's a lactation consultant and childbirth educator. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And a little later on the phone, we'll be joined by Julie Boucher-Horowitz. She's a lactation consultant and executive director of the New York Milk Bank. She's just getting back to her office, so we'll check in with her as soon as she's back. And listeners, this is a topic with many elements, and I'm sure you might have questions, so we want to welcome your comments and feedback. The number here is 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can find me on Twitter at MMACMedia. Karen's on Twitter as well. What's your handle, Karen?
It's Karen Shakurji, at Karen Shakurji.
Spell your last name for us.
So it's K-A-R-E-N, S like Sam, H-A-K-E-R-D-G-E.
And you can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org. So I'd like to start things off with Karen. How did this story first get on your radar?
The story first got on my radar because of a funny little thing that happened in my Google alerts, which is that I got some alert about some development regarding a milk bank happening in Rochester, Minnesota. I believe is what
the other Rochester,
and so that came in by accident, and I just started kind of clicking around on that, and I said, "What is this? I've never heard of this before," and so I just kind of went down a rabbit hole, and then maybe a couple hours later, found Diane listed online, called her up. You gave me a little lay of the land, a little intro into the world, and then I just started researching it, and then you know came up for air about a month later.
It's very thorough reporting, and I know you ran into many issues with research and numbers, and you did such a great job of outlining all of that. So listeners, I encourage you to listen to those stories on our website. So let's talk about the health benefits of breast milk and then, of course, donor milk, and I'll turn this over to all of our panelists. Why is breast milk good for babies, especially premature babies? There's always those formula campaigns, but why are we always seeming to go back to breast milk?
Well, I'll take a stab first. What we know about mom's milk is quite a bit, actually. We could spend another 2 hours probably discussing the benefits. We know it's the first choice for every baby, regardless of whether they're premature. We know specifically in premature babies, which is an area that I'm particularly passionate about because that's what I do every day. Is that it really does impact their long-term neurodevelopment, so their brain growth how they meet their milestones. It reduces risk of infection, specifically necrotizing enterocolitis, bloodstream infections. It's also been demonstrated to be beneficial for other long-term health things like allergies, asthma, obesity. We know the benefits that it has in babies born at term as well. So.
And some infants can't process formula, is that correct? Some premature infants have struggle with formula. Can you shed a little light on that?
That's right. So we know that in addition to their lungs, their brain, other vital organs that are still growing, the intestine is one of those. And so the ability for the intestine to be able to receive those nutrients, it is surprisingly can be quite difficult for them to process something other than human milk. And so, unfortunately, the only other typical solution is a cow's milk-based formula.
Mm-hmm. Diane, do you have many people coming in to speak with you about donor milk?
I think that the donor milk, the whole idea of donor milk is still so new. I do have a lot of people that will contact me or will ask me about getting donor milk kind of from friends or from family members. And I think a lot of people, the thought of donor milk is very scary to them. If you say, oh, well, you know, there's donor milk available or there's donor milk banks, a lot of people don't realize that that is something that's happening now. And they get very scared at the thought of donor milk and what would that mean for my baby and is that safe? There's a lot of conversation about that, which is why I was so glad that Karen did the research on it and really put it out there, because it's such an important issue for these little babies, for all babies, but preemies especially too.
When we have Julie on the phone, we can talk about the difference between nonprofit milk banks, for-profit milk banks, and then quote-unquote informal sharing, which Karen was telling me about yesterday, and something that you probably get a lot of questions about.
I do get a lot about that.
Yeah, and that's Craigslist, right? Going to friends or...
It's definitely shows itself in many different ways. Yes.
Very diplomatic answer.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, listeners, we will pop back to that topic a bit later when Julie joins us on the phone. But for now, the phrase liquid gold, that's such a strong statement to make. How can donor milk be the difference between life and death?
I think simply... like Dr. Myers was putting it, for these very fragile premature infants who are so susceptible to necrotizing enterocolitis and other things that are that can happen to them in the NICU while they're still developing, breast milk is definitely the lifeline. When they can't, if they can't process and can't digest the cow's milk, the breast milk is really the way to go. It has been shown to save these babies' lives, and not only save their lives, but babies that are born very premature often are spending how long in the NICU? Months, could be months. But babies that are getting specifically only breast milk tend to do so much better and are discharged sooner from what they're seeing too. I don't know if that's what you're seeing as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty obvious when we have babies who, thankfully, the mom is pumping, we're able to provide her milk. But there are circumstances where mother's milk is not available. Mom has a competing health condition that requires her to take medications. She has a health condition that precludes her from being able to provide sufficient quantities, like the story you read at the beginning. That's not an uncommon occurrence in the NICU. And so we really can see the benefit as a neonatal community is still providing a similar a safe feeding solution to these babies that reduces their risk of complications substantially. So.
Is there much research out there about the safety of donor milk? I know URMC is part of a 17-site study regarding some of the safety and efficacy of donor milk. Can you shed a little light on that?
Yeah, the study that we're involved in, so we participate in the Neonatal Research Network, which is, as you mentioned, is about 17 centers, which comprises about 30 plus neonatal intensive care units around the country. This study is specifically looking at the long-term neurodevelopmental effects of a diet comprised primarily of donor milk for premature babies during hospitalization. So these are strictly for babies whose moms don't have enough supply, choose not to provide or can't provide for medical reasons, and babies receive either donor milk or formula, to determine whether donor milk has similar beneficial effects as mom's own milk on brain growth and development several years down the road.
Mm-hmm. And Karen and I talked a little bit off the air about supplies in hospitals. And I know that donor milk is not readily available at Strong for various reasons, and much of that is tied to cost. But if mothers are in the hospital and they're struggling and they need to turn to an option like donor milk, would they need to go to a bank? Is there some special program through the hospital? How would that work?
So that's a good question. So we don't have a standing mechanism for accruing donor milk. It's really on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, it's not something that we're yet using routinely for clinical use, although we're working quite a bit on that. Karen and I have spoken quite a bit about that. So mm-hmm. It's something that we're hoping to bring into play sometime this coming year. As of right now, there's not a great mechanism. Diane alluded to the fact that the culture around using human milk for humans is still something that I think is important in the Rochester community as we talk about this issue that is addressed, that this is really, when done correctly and procured from a milk bank, is safe. It's probably safer than formula, which has risks. And some NICUs actually approach formula with a much higher stand on the risks so far that they have you sign consent before they give your baby formula, which is a very different approach, but it ascribes the risks that we know associated with using formula in these babies. So,
I didn't know that. I didn't know that that was something that happened. Is that something that happens with all kinds of procedures going on in the NICU, or are you talking specifically about a release form, like FYI, you know?
Yeah, so certainly with procedures, surgical procedures, other procedures, there's many things that we obtain consent for from families. This is an out-of-state NICU. Neonatology is a small world, so we all chat. And their approach at this particular hospital is for babies of a certain gestational age or certain birth weight. Those babies get mom's milk always. When it's not available, they receive donor milk. If the parents do not want donor milk, they have to sign a consent form to use formula because they believe so strongly that human milk is the right thing to do.
Wow. So there's a consent form specifically for giving an infant in the NICU
formula.
That's right.
It's the first time I'd heard of it, but it's a very different approach. I think it sheds light on the importance of it.
I think we have Julie on the phone now. This is Julie Boucher-Horowitz, and she's a lactation consultant and executive director of the New York Milk Bank. Julie, thanks for joining us. I know it's been a hectic morning for you, so thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So let's just talk about milk banks for a moment, the history of milk banks. For those who may not be familiar, I wasn't before reading Karen's report, but how common were they? I believe you started with in the 80s, Karen, you started tracking numbers then, and then they sort of dropped off a bit for various reasons, and then there was a comeback. So yep. I'll turn this over to Karen and Julie if you want to talk a little bit about the history.
Julie, I think you were actually one of the first people that had mentioned that to me, and I thought that the history there was so fascinating, especially when you're thinking about kind of what was going on in the 80s and then how things unfolded in terms of blood donation banks and donor milk banks. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, prior to the 80s, I believe that the United States had about 30 milk banks. And then when the AIDS epidemic hit, many of them virtually closed overnight. I think there were less than a handful that remained open. And that didn't happen with blood. We made blood accessible and safe to everyone, but in a way, human milk at the time was considered dispensable because we had formula that we could use. And Brazil took the opposite approach, and they made donor milk safe, and a result of that is that they became the world leaders in milk banking because everyone is now trying to catch up with what Brazil has done. But gradually what happened was the Human Milk Banking Association of North America was formed, and they have started to establish the guidelines for the safety and quality control of human milk. And more milk banks started to come on. They are the umbrella organization for nonprofit milk banks. And it took a while for New York to actually join the bandwagon. We were one of the later ones. It's a little different in New York because it's regulated by the state, by the Department of Health, which we think is a good thing. Human milk in New York State is considered a tissue. And as such, any hospital that uses donor milk must have a license by the Department of Health to dispense it. And we have to have a license. And all of our milk collection sites must have a license. So there's a little stricter guidelines, but we feel it gives us an extra level of safety because we have to follow not just the FDA, because the FDA rates human milk as a food. We have to follow the Department of Health, and we have to follow Habana's guidelines. And since Habana came on board, there's now 23 milk banks in North America. And we opened, the New York Milk Bank opened up officially in September, and we're beginning to join the, we can now provide milk to New York State hospitals and residents. There's 23 hospitals in New York State now using milk, and that number is growing monthly.
And Julie, before you established, before you opened your doors in September, where was milk coming from? I think you were telling me about this a little bit when I came to visit the milk bank, but how are we getting milk here?
At first, milk was coming from Delaware. There was a Delaware milk bank, and that one stayed open after the AIDS epidemic hit. It was a small milk bank in Delaware, but it remained open, and they were providing milk to New York, but it wasn't in the hospitals yet, so it was just going to outpatient communities, to people in the community. North Carolina obtained a license as well. And what happened was Delaware became a profitable milk bank, and North Carolina felt that they could not continue to dispense milk to New York State because they needed to keep the milk in their state for their preemies. So Ohio came on board in 2010 and obtained a license, and then in 2012, Massachusetts obtained a license. But I was working in the hospitals at the time that Delaware and North Carolina were providing milk to New York, and when they dropped out of the scene, that made me very nervous, and that's when I started trying to talk about and recruit people to open a milk bank in New York State. I was afraid that something like that might happen again if there was a shortage, that a milk bank would not be able to provide, an out-of-state milk bank would not provide to New York State.
And Julie, you just brought up something that I think that Megan wanted to make sure that we talk about, which is the kind of relationship between nonprofit and for-profit banks, and whether or not that's really something, if there's a tension there or competition, and kind of how they compare.
Well, I'm not sure that, I think there might be a little tension in that sometimes the profitable milk banks will question our procedures because one of the profitable milk banks, I think, has DNA testing of their donors, and we don't do that. It would be prohibitively expensive to check all of our milk and do a DNA analysis to make sure it matches the donors. But profitable milk banks also pay their donors, and that might be an incentive that's a little bit different than ours. We're nonprofit. We don't pay our donors. It's a donation. We do not check their DNA, but we assume that that mother's milk, that it is her milk. We develop a relationship with the donor. It takes weeks to be approved as a donor, and there's a lot of communication going on. So we don't feel it's necessary to take a DNA analysis of the milk. That's the only piece that I think is a bone of contention between the two industries, other than they charge a lot more than we do, and we keep our costs down as much as possible. It's a processing fee to pay for this facility, the salaries, the pasteurization of the milk, the equipment that we need. And we're not in it to make a profit. So we try to keep the cost as low as possible.
Julie, we're going to just put you on hold for 1 minute, if you don't mind, because I think we're having a connection issue with your phone. So our engineers will just test that out. And in the meantime, I'll turn back to our in-studio panel with a question about licensing, which Julie was talking about. And Karen, you mentioned yesterday that donor milk is considered a tissue mm-hmm. and not food, so mm-hmm. there are different licensing issues that surround that. Can you explain a little? I don't think most people knew that. At least I didn't.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that out as well, but that's part of what Julie was just talking about with needing. New York State is one of, I don't know if you two know the exact number, but I think it's a handful of states mm-hmm. that regulate donor breast milk as a tissue as opposed to a food. And because of that, there are all, you know, kind of a whole set of protocols that you have to follow. And that's part of why Julie was just talking about being dependent on other states that made sure to maintain those licenses in order to sell to New York. Why does New York State regulate as a tissue? Or, that's something that I think I asked maybe 15 people, and nobody ever could give me a straight answer beyond, you know, maybe the Department of Health feels this is something they should be involved in terms of safety. But, nobody was ever able to kind of give me a very specific reason. Do you two have any thoughts about that?
I have no idea why they would do that. I mean, my guess would be, too, that it would be a safety issue and just kind of making sure that the Department of Health was staying involved, which makes sense. But otherwise, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Myers?
I don't know either.
This can be part three of your report.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We've
had a couple questions come through via Twitter. Cool. This is from Horace. He says, I reached out to the La Leche League to see if I could contact a breast milk donor, and they were very cut and dry legal, that they couldn't make any connection of that kind. A prescription would have been financially impossible. I just needed 3 days' worth of milk while I took medication. I was nuts how impossible it was. Ended up with formula.
Well, that's sad. Mm-hmm. My first thought on that is, well, there's a lot of thoughts I have on that. But whether or not that mom really needed to stop breastfeeding for that medication, often that's not correct information. And I wish somebody had led her in the direction of maybe the I know Strong has a great lactation center that covers medication questions. Lactation consultants can field that for her as well. So that might have been a situation where she maybe didn't even need to go that route. And there's so much misinformation out there that it's too bad.
Who do you recommend people contact if they have questions like that? And should they contact someone like you? Should they call the hospital? What's their best option?
They can contact a lactation consultant like me. That's a great way to start or a great place to start. They can contact the hospitals. All the hospitals have lactation consultants that will gladly answer questions about that or point them in the direction that they need to go in. And most medical personnel will err on the side of caution and say, I'm not sure if you should be taking this medication and breastfeeding. And that's a scary thought for a mom that maybe they shouldn't be breastfeeding if they're taking a certain medication. But often it's very safe.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll address some questions that you've had come in about cost. And there's a lot to discuss here. So we'll have all our panelists back on the phone in the studio. I see the phone starting to ring. So I'll just remind our listeners, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're in Rochester, the phone number is 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can tweet your question to MMACMedia, or you can email your question to connections@WXXI.org. More on donor breast milk when we come back. Coming up in
Sorry
our second hour, what can
she
we expect
like
from the Trump administration in terms of environmental and climate issues? We'll answer all of your questions and your comments. That's coming up next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. Before we left for our break, we talked a little bit about cost. I mentioned in the intro that a local family paid $4 an ounce for their breast milk, and affordability is a big issue surrounding this subject. So I'd like to open it up to our panel just to talk about cost in general. Is $4 an ounce pretty standard when you're going to a nonprofit milk bank?
That's what I heard was standard. And I think sometimes maybe that's why people go to informal sharing, because trying to pay for that themselves, especially for a situation with a baby in the NICU where it might be months, that is a lot of money.
Yeah, you start thinking, so what does $4 an ounce mean? So depending on the age of the baby, how much they eat in a given day, but, you know, a typical newborn who's a couple weeks old might feed, you know, 20 or 30 ounces over the course of a day. That would be very normal. And so you start doing the math, that's on a day basis, you're looking at $120, $150 as the baby gets older, needs more milk. That can be a big hurdle. It certainly is a hurdle for families. Especially when you start thinking about the longevity, is that might be sustainable for a week, but what about 3 months? That is certainly something that we're challenged with. How do we do that? And so in the hospital, when we think about how do we do that, it's really thinking about what are the benefits, right? And I think the reality is that in the long run for preemies, it's not just cost neutral, but probably a cost savings on the whole to the healthcare system, to payers, and so that this is ultimately something we'd like that for babies who need it, that it's not an issue for families. They're not really seeking it out on their own, like the question we had earlier, that it's something that over time I'd like to see become much more readily available.
Mm-hmm. Julie, how do you respond to questions about cost when people come to your milk bank?
You know, right now, if the baby is an inpatient and the hospital is using donor milk, the hospital absorbs the cost. If the baby is an inpatient and the hospital is not using donor milk, some hospitals are permitting the patients to pay for it themselves and bring it in. But the New York Milk Bank has been working really hard, and the reason I was late in coming to this call is we're lobbying the governor's office and our legislature to put in the budget to pay for donor milk for premature infants, all infants under 1,500 grams who are inpatients, and also other sick babies who fall under a critically ill category. As Dr. Meyer said, it's a cost savings. It's not even cost neutral. It's a cost savings. So that would cover babies in the hospital. We're really hopeful that this may actually get into the budget, not as a bill. There was a bill which was vetoed by the governor because it was a little too broad, but as actually part of the budget for Medicaid. Then what do we do about outpatients, babies who are sick? We were able to get reimbursement, actually prior approval through an insurance company in New York for a baby who's an outpatient, and for 8 months of donor milk for that baby. So that's been that third time an insurance company has agreed. So we need to lobby the commercial insurance companies to start paying for sick babies who are outpatients as well. Now, will that trickle down to healthy full-term infants? Probably not for a while, if that ever happens. We don't know. First, we have to try to get coverage for these sick infants and premature infants.
We could go down a rabbit hole talking about insurance. But Karen, when you were doing your research, what are some of the biggest issues regarding insurance that you came across?
It's exactly what Julie just referenced. She referenced the third family that she knows of to get coverage for, you know, eight months. And we've talked about infants in the NICU needing access to donor milk for a week or for a couple weeks or for a couple months. But, it can be longer than that, and not all families have access to an endless amount of resources. You know, so what are some of the biggest issues? Just coverage. And, you know, I've had conversations with a couple of insurance companies that, you know, had never heard of donor milk, kind of laughed at me a little bit and asking questions and, you know, reference some, you know, well, are we going to cover every experimental treatment that's out there? And, you know, we have to wait for the research and all of that. So I think, you know, part of what Diane was referencing earlier, maybe about some of the fear, but also some skepticism about whether or not this is something worth, you know, kind of covering. So it seems that we're still kind of far from even getting to specific coverage issues and more about just the mentality and the attitude. Mm-hmm. That's what I picked up on.
There's part four of your series. Yeah. I'm just assigning you more work. Yeah.
There is a lot of research to show that human milk is life-saving, not just for preemies, but for full-term babies and other aspects of health as well. So when you say that, you know, you kind of got laughed at by the insurance company saying, well, this is experimental. It's human milk. It's been around for millions of years. It's not typically experimental, I wouldn't think.
I'm not in the medical, you know, kind of field, but, you know, I think the idea was why can't they just have formula? You know, that was something that was said to me by somebody at an insurance company.
Yeah, and I think I would say to that is I think that reflects a lot of the culture around almost around an acceptance or lack of acceptance yet mm-hmm. by you know, communities. By we, you know, there are still people who maybe take care of premature babies who you know, may still question or feel a little bit unsettled about the, you know, this idea of it's somebody else's milk. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, when you talk about the literature, I think the literature specifically for donor milk is clear. There is no question about what's been published that donor milk is beneficial to premature babies during hospitalization. I don't think there's any debating that. And I don't think you'd find anyone in our NICU that would debate that. Mm-hmm. But the idea that somebody else, my baby's receiving somebody else's milk, you know, Karen and I talked about this. I mentioned this when we chatted. You know, we wouldn't withhold an antibiotic if we thought it was the right thing to do.
Right.
But I think the evidence here is clear that it's the right thing to do for preemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a question that I continually came back to while I was reporting this was, why isn't there a greater acceptance of this, whether or not it's in the hospital or just parents knowing about it? And yeah, something that I'm still a little confused by. So.
I think the education is just lacking, mm-hmm. really. I think that's what it comes down to. You know, we came out of, you know, like Julie was saying, the 1980s, where I said, formula's fine, shut down the milk banks, and now we're trying to turn that around, and it takes a long time to turn that around. Mm-hmm. And I think that education is just really lacking in a lot of places.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the ease with which, right, so just knowing something is maybe better or the right thing to do never makes it easy. To accomplish, right? The ease
naive
of
optimist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If I mean, right. If you want a can of formula, we all know where you can go to pick one up
right.
for
mm-hmm.
relatively small pennies.
Right.
In the hospitals, it's no different, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they're a company too. They're trying to make money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is so much more readily available.
There's a lot of babies, full-term babies, that struggle with just your average formula and need to go on something specialized if they're having trouble with it. And there have been times where insurance companies will pick that up, will pick up the cost of specialized formula because babies need specialized formula because they cannot digest the, you know, typical off-the-shelf formula. And insurance companies will cover that. But we're having a hard time getting mm-hmm. them to cover milk,
right.
donor milk. It's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to jump to the phones. This is Barbara in Rochester. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for calling the show.
Hello?
Hi, can you hear us?
This is Barbara.
Hi, Barbara. Did you have a question or comment?
Well, I wanted to give you some historical information. My daughter was born August 31st, 1972, and through the 8 months after she was born, I was a human milk donor to Strong Memorial Hospital. So the practice of donor milk goes back a long ways in our community. I was very excited because at the time, as a young mother, I couldn't afford to take a taxi cab, but Strong would send a taxi cab regularly to my house to pick up my milk, which was kind of a little chortle on the side.
That's wonderful.
Go ahead, Karen.
Really? The hospital sent a taxi to pick up donor milk, and you would put your milk in the taxi, and the taxi driver would drive it back to the hospital? Like that?
Perfect. Correct.
Wow.
Regulations must have been very different in 1970.
My daughter was born when quintuplets were born in New Jersey the same day, and I was manufacturing enough milk for not only my daughter, but also for the quints. So I continued to do that. I was a La Leche League mom, and one of the La Leche League leaders put me in touch with Strong, and I did go through a health questionnaire. I did, provide my personal health history. So that was covered even back in 1972. It wasn't, oh, thank goodness there's milk, but it was very, very carefully and very thoughtfully collected. And the idea of building up a relationship was also part of the donation process at that time. Additionally, I was unfortunately in an automobile accident, and I was taking a whole variety of painkillers and muscle relaxants. And at the time, Dr. Ruth Lawrence would run every single one of the medications through the computer program she had developed to determine whether or not the medication would adversely affect the nursling. So that was an absolutely amazing service that allayed my concerns, in the few weeks, months after my automobile accident. So Strong has always been on the cutting edge of human care, whether it's infant or any age. So I've been very, very thankful for that.
Thank you, Barbara.
The only other comment I would add is that we knew by the time my daughter was 6 months old that she was going to need surgery when she was 22 months old. So after introducing food, I continued to nurse. And when she went in, when she came out of her surgery, I had encoded her with a half a dozen little, twinkle, twinkle, little star, and mommy's here, everything is fine. And so when I started saying those phrases, when she would fuss waking up from the antibiotic or the anesthetic, she would calm right down and start nursing and then go back to sleep. And she left the hospital both times she had eye surgery, the same day as the eye surgery. Normally with little ones, they keep them overnight to continue to observe. But both times she was up and walking within 6 hours of coming up from surgery. So there are so many more benefits. There are, of course, the nutritional benefits, but there are bonding benefits. There are just so many other benefits. It's a parenting style to continue to let your child know that you love and care about them and you'll be there for them. So for me, breastfeeding the dynamics were fully experienced and very much appreciated by me and by my daughter.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us. I'll let our panelists respond. I think things in 1972 and 73 are probably a little bit different than they are now regarding being able to send your donor milk to the hospital. But Dr. Myers, is that something you were familiar with? Here's a question. Are there any plans to try to do something like that again? Julie, I know you're back on the line with us. Any surprises in that story?
Well,
a couple of things. Number one, Strong is a hospital. Most of the milk banks in those years were in hospitals. Rather than being community-based, they were located within hospitals. And then another thought was the taxi ride. You know, I don't know if you've heard about our milk riders, but they're volunteer female motorcyclists, and they're the Sirens Motorcycle Club of New York City. They are volunteers for us, and they are picking up milk at our depots and bringing it to our facility to be pasteurized. And we also, as volunteers, use them when we have an emergency delivery, which we had on December 9th, Friday night at 11, I think it was a quarter of 12, midnight. We had an emergency call that a Bronx hospital was out of milk, donor milk, and what were they going to do all night? And we were able to get our milk, one of our milk riders, to come pick up 10 bottles and deliver it at midnight to a hospital in the Bronx. So it just reminded me of something like that.
Great, great. Dr. Myers, anything to add?
No, I think, I mean, like you said, certainly in the early 70s, the regulations and the kind of processing and handling was probably different, certainly, than it is today. And certainly some of the regulations at the state level that we've already discussed are probably different today than they were then. Barbara mentioned Dr. Ruth Lawrence, who I think we would be remiss in not mentioning her involvement in not just our community, but really around the country and globally with her involvement in breastfeeding and her contributions to breastfeeding medicine, and really her role in kind of founding that field and the importance of breast milk.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara also raises a great issue of the community supporting other community members by providing milk. And I think Patrick in Rochester has a question that relates to that. Hi, Patrick.
Thanks for having this discussion. I'm a dad. I have a three-year-old and a seven-month-old, and I've witnessed the miracle that breastfeeding is. We've been very fortunate that we haven't required donor milk, but I did want to, you know, just first thank the panel and thank WXXI and Megan for having this conversation. I think it's so critically important. When you're a new parent, you're not flush with money. You're learning new things. You're up in the middle of the night, and I just really think that donor milk and breastfeeding support should be free and, you know, readily available the minute, a child is born, whether it's premature or not. And my question is, locally here in the Rochester area, what can people do, you know, besides actually donating milk? As a dad of young kids, I'm just interested in what can we do politically, what can we do with the insurance companies to, to make it cost, to reduce the cost prohibitive nature of getting human milk to premature babies and, you know, babies who don't have access to their own mother's milk, locally here in Rochester.
Great. Thank you, Patrick.
Can I comment on that? Because this is Julie. We are asking the public to please call the governor's office and ask him to put donor milk in the budget that they're negotiating, in the executive budget. That's what we're asking New York residents to do. And that will help. If once Medicaid starts to reimburse for donor milk, we will probably see the commercial insurance companies do it as well. So if you want to call the governor's office and just ask him to support putting donor milk into the budget, that would be a great help.
Julie, is there a way, besides calling, is there a way electronically to communicate that information? That for some, that's, most people don't remember that a cell phone is a phone. Is there a way electronically to convey that message? I know the support for the bill, a lot of it was done through letter writing, emails. Is there a way to do that? Electronically?
I think there is. I think the governor has an email, and
he does. Yes, my colleague Kat is working hard behind the glass to send me contact information, so I can share that with you right now. His email address, listeners, is gov.cuomo@chamber.state.ny.us. So again, that's gov.cuomo at chamber.state.ny.us. That's his email. And then his phone number, if you have a pen, 518-474-8390, 518-474-8390. Thank you, Kat.
Something that I think wasn't mentioned yet that I'm sure Dr. Myers can even kind of speak to as well is the families themselves. You know, we've talked a lot about the preemies, how important this donor milk is for those babies, which it is, you know, crucially important. But when a family is experiencing something like preterm birth, the stress that's involved in that, the hours that are spent in the NICU, if they have, you know, other children at home, just the toll that this takes on a family, and then to know that they can't have the most important thing easily accessible to them is devastating. And it's that is one of the reasons why women struggle so much to try to get breast milk to these babies, and why they sometimes don't have enough of their own breast milk available, because the stress that is just intertwined in these babies and their, you know, being in the NICU, it is an unexpected shock to them to have a newborn that's sick, and then to know that they're trying to support their whole life with breast milk. I mean, the what those families are dealing with is awful. And then if they have to try to fight for donor milk too, would be just horrible for them.
Yeah, that emotional piece is so important to discuss. And Dr. Myers, are there teams in the hospital? Are there support groups, now that we're on the subject? Are there people that families can talk to if they need some emotional support?
Absolutely. So we have a whole team dedicated to supporting families like that. We have a family advisory council that meets, that provides resources and support, can connect families with other families who've potentially gone through a similar process. Maybe it's their child needs to have surgery shortly after birth, and what is that experience like as a parent, or, you know, a parent who's had an extremely premature infant? What, you know, how do you survive for 4 months, 5 months in the neonatal intensive care unit when life still happens around you? You still have jobs and other children, and kind of the, you know, life doesn't come to a screeching halt. You know, things still happen. So we have a whole team who really are quite wonderful in addressing some of these emotional needs. The reality that stress affects breast milk supply in these moms is crucial. So I guess I would, you know, we've been saying all along how important mom's milk is. I want to say thank you to all the moms who have supplied and are supplying now and will supply for their babies. It is the best medicine, and we encourage it strongly, because as physicians and as nurses and other staff members, lactation consultants, we recognize the importance of it. But we understand that, you know, the stress that they're experiencing from having a newborn in the neonatal intensive care unit, we certainly hope is not from us. The truth is that they're the only one privileged enough to provide milk for their baby. Dad can't do it. I can't do it. It's something that's, you know, really valuable. But, you know, we recognize that stress in the NICU is common. It happens.
Mm-hmm. We've only scratched the surface. And I know, mm-hmm. listeners, if you have more questions, you should definitely listen to Karen's reports, which are available on our website at WXXINews.org. And we can have some follow-up conversations as things progress. Hopefully we'll hear from Governor Cuomo's office. I'll try to post his contact information on our podcast page if you're interested in expressing your support for donor milk and donor milk banks. I'd like to thank all my guests for joining me today. Dr. Jeffrey Myers from Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong, thanks for coming in. Diane Cassidy, and Diane, share how people can get a hold of you if they'd like to seek your services.
If they'd like to seek my services, or if they would like to donate milk, I can get you in touch with our local donor depot. We do have a depot here in Rochester, and I can be reached at Diane Cassidy, DianneCassidy, at rochester.rr.com, or 585-261-4834.
Perfect. And Julie Boucher Horowitz, thank you for joining us on the phone. Karen Shikurji, my colleague, excellent reporting. More Connections is next.